This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, alternative finance guru Chris Martinson.
I'm a realistic optimist. I do believe that the trends and forces that are in play will have to come to some sort of a resolution. In that resolution, I can't see any possible conclusion other than one where there's generally a lower standard of living, because just economically, we've been living well beyond our means in terms of our expenditures, debt levels, all of that. But we've been living well beyond our means from our natural capital as well, specifically around energy, but also around soil, water, other things like that. We're going to have to make an adjustment. So my hope is that we get to make these adjustments gradually and on our own terms. My worry is that we will deny this reality as long as possible. I mean, we at the official levels will attempt to maintain and preserve the status quo. We'll do everything possible to just sort of keep things moving along, and we'll face a much more, shall I say, sudden adjustment period. That one worries me quite a bit.
The author of When Technology Fails, Matt Stein.
But every now and then, the Earth gets stalked by a really huge solar storm called an extreme geomagnetic event. And if that was to happen today, then life as we know it would cease to exist for many people on the planet. And let me explain that.
Plus a rare Alex Smith rant on the popular delusions of 2012. Most of us have a gut worry about the state of governments, big banks, and big finance, like maybe we'll wake up one morning with nothing. Our guest, Chris Martinson, trained as a scientist but retrained in business. He made good money in the investment world with a big American corporation. Then the Martinson family changed life dramatically. We'll ask him why and then pick his brain about things we all wish we knew. Chris Martinson, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's my pleasure.
Chris, in a talk at Oxford University in 2010, the very wealthy investor Jim Rogers told students to forget about financial careers and go study agriculture or mining. In a way, you made a similar transition. Tell us about your journey from the business world to a more rural life.
You know, this it was a, like all good journeys, I was a little bit self-interested to start. I was very concerned with what was happening around 2000, 2001, as the economy shredded itself and my portfolio did poorly, and everything I'd saved for, worked hard, lived the American dream, played by the rules, and still I was losing. And so I looked into the economy and almost immediately shocked myself with what I found, things that were not commonly talked about, not in my circle, not in the newspapers, things about debt, deficits, overall levels of economic sort of weakness that really spoke to me in a way that said, this could end badly. And I started digging deeper and went into the data and suddenly saw that the future that I was counting on almost certainly wasn't going to be there when I got there. The future that I was counting on was the one we all counted on. It's going to be slightly larger. It's going to be a little bit more of the same. There's more opportunities. The economy is going to grow. And once I saw the data that's now collected in the crash course and book and on my website, once I got this data in one spot, I said, I'm looking at a very distinct possibility that there could be disruptions, severe dislocations in our economy and by extension in our food systems and by extension in our energy systems. That is, I saw a world of complex interconnection that was at once very cost effective and also, if viewed a certain way, potentially very brittle. And that concerned me. So my wife, my children, and I, we made the transition away from a fairly unsustainable lifestyle to one that's more resilient. And on the surface, it looks like we moved out into the country a little bit. But what we're really doing is creating both deeper points of resilience in our own personal lives, as well as more community engagement.
And there is so much stress out there about banking and broke governments as the trillions accumulate, and I'm hearing a growing group of bloggers and radio hosts and other people who just wish it would all end somehow, and some are even cheering for a collapse. Where are you on that spectrum?
Oh, careful what you wish for. I'm not in the camp that's wishing for any of this to happen. I'm a realistic optimist. I do believe that the trends and forces that are in play will have to come to some sort of a resolution. In that resolution, I can't see any possible conclusion other than one where there's generally a lower standard of living, because just economically, we've been living well beyond our means in terms of our expenditures, debt levels, all of that. But we've been living well beyond our means from our natural capital as well, specifically around energy, but also around soil, water, other things like that. We're going to have to make an adjustment. So my hope is that we get to make these adjustments gradually and on our own terms. My worry is that we will deny this reality as long as possible. I mean, we at the official levels will attempt to maintain and preserve the status quo. We'll do everything possible to just sort of keep things moving along, and we'll face a much more, shall I say, sudden adjustment period. That one worries me quite a bit.
And there are several factors playing around here, and one of them, of course, is perhaps peak oil, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you a pressure point that I see and that a lot of our listeners believe in because of climate science is the pressure from climate change. Where do you stand on that?
Well, that's something that's almost entirely impossible to predict what the immediate impacts of that are going to be. And my stance on this is that we are going to run into and encounter very severe, very immediate, very proximate difficulties that will impact people very directly in the economy first, probably in the energy sector second, probably in the environment around climate change third. The climate change, besides being unpredictable, is a much longer sweeping sort of a trend. I have much more immediate concerns that I'm looking at this point.
Well, I'd agree with you, except for the summer in April that we're all experiencing. But you could be right, and I think I generally agree with you. You know, a scientist named Tim Garrett wrote a 2009 paper saying that there is a historic relationship between energy and wealth. More energy makes more wealth, less energy makes less. What are your thoughts about those relationships between energy availability and wealth?
If you have energy, you can build and form all sorts of other types of wealth. And whether you have a capitalist system or a Marxist system, and whether you've got good laws or bad laws, or you protect intellectual property rights and all those other niceties that sort of distinguish why we might live in one country or another, all become useless and irrelevant if you don't have energy to start with. So I think we can appreciate this if we were farming and it's just us, and as long as our farming efforts are returning more calories, that is energy, than we're expending, then we have the ability to form wealth, to store food, to take that food and do other things with it. Those are our profits. Without that food as that energy source, though, nothing else on this hypothetical farm is possible. It all begins with energy. And we tend to lump it in societally. It's a commodity. Look, you want to talk commodities, we can talk about silver and grains and cotton and molybdenum and oil, and we just sort of mix it in there, but it's not equivalent. None of those other commodities are even possible without oil. So oil is, or energy is, that is the foundational beginning of all other activities. So I look at this very, very carefully, because there's a story here which isn't just the amount of oil that's available, which is really what people mostly talk about in the peak oil story. Will we have more or less? What really matters is the quality of that energy. How much energy are we getting back for the energy we're expending? That story is really undertold at this point, and I believe is the key to understanding why everything is sort of unfolding the way it is today.
Yeah, well, we really see that in Canada, where the tar sands, just so much natural gas is being burned to boil it out, and so much energy being expended. You get about 3 barrels of oil for every barrel of energy you put into it. Well, look, on your blog at chrismartinson.com, you ran a 2-part series by Gregor MacDonald called The Race for BTUs. I thought it was excellent. What do you make of the claims that North America will become an oil giant once again?
I'll laugh at that. Because, look, when we're drilling in the Bakken fields right now, the shale oil plays are one of the headline stories that have been run in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes. You just can't open a magazine without reading about this wonderful tight oil plays that we're getting. And here's what we need to understand about that story. Every single well that we drill in the Bakken play right now is returning about 150 barrels per day of production. Well, let's compare that to the United States consuming about 18 million barrels per day. And I think you can see there's a pretty enormous gap. You'd have to drill a lot of wells. And it turns out when you calculate the total acreage that's available, and it's immense, 20,000 square miles of land can be drilled in North Dakota. it still doesn't even remotely get you close to filling the gap for how much the United States consumes. That's part one. Canada consumes on a per capita basis even slightly more than the U.S. The general trend in energy use has been more and more and more, year after year after year. There are two big forces at work here. One, we want to be burning more because that's how economies grow. And remember, an economy is just things moving from point A to point B and people consuming it. And all of that starts with energy. So if you want more economy and it means you want more things, you have to have more energy. That story is being clipped at, though, by the idea that the existing fields, that many of which were drilled in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, are depleting and are running out. So today, in order for North America to just be producing slightly more energy or oil, we have to be making up for shortfalls in existing fields, cover that gap, then we can start talking about new additions to the overall mix. I've analyzed the numbers. There's really no possible way that the United States is going to get to be anything but an oil importer for the conceivable future. My guess is forever.
And what about the lack of refineries? That's another thing covered in that story. Three refineries on the U.S. East Coast have closed because the oil they were built for is too expensive or going elsewhere. We're down to the heavy oil, and we don't have the pipelines to connect up to the refineries we do have. What have you heard about this, and how might that affect the ordinary person?
Well, this is going to affect us extraordinarily. If we'd, instead of taking $1 trillion and giving it to the bankers, had taken that same trillion and put it into our infrastructure. So what's being pointed out here is that, you know, oil refineries, it's much more complicated than most people are aware. They're built for and tuned for a specific grade of oil. Oil comes in all different grades, from stuff that you literally have to move around with a spatula, it's so thick, to really light, sweet stuff that's practically gasoline straight out of the ground, and everything in between. Tar sands being a really, or oil sands, what they're being called now, being an extraordinarily dense, viscous, goopy stuff, right? Each one of these different grades of oil requires a different manufacturing process or refining process in order to crack it and turn it into the wonderful things that we use on a daily basis. And many of these refineries were built for, obviously, the better grades of oil. And now we're down to the nasty stuff. It's really heavy and sour, meaning it's got impurities in it, sulfur, vanadium, nitrogen, stuff that we don't want, and you have to get rid of in the refining process. Well, refining is a low-margin business, and when it turns out that you are being squeezed by higher input costs on one end, a lower quality of feedstock on the other end, it really just destroys profits and profitability. So most of these refineries that are shutting down because they would require an extraordinary capital infusion to bring them up to grade to process a different grade of crude, and it just doesn't make economic sense.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with alternative finance guru Chris Martinson. Many people expect a destabilizing blow to come from high gas prices at the pump, but I think it may come in the grocery store. There's potential damage to this year's crops from lack of snow cover in the prairies. A big part of the south and east are experiencing drought conditions, and there's a host of other problems. Chris, do you expect a food crisis in the coming times?
You know, it was, when was it? It was December 2006, everything was fine. January 2007, everything's fine. February 2007, there's a world food crisis. And it happened just like that. And it wasn't because we suddenly ran out of rice. It was that the perception of scarcity suddenly developed, and we saw countries hoard food because as every country knows that it's really important that you don't run out of food. And so for a long time, we've been watching world grain stocks be in almost perfect balance with demand. So supply and demand, very well balanced. And then something started to happen, and particularly it's accelerated, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years. There have been these extraordinary weather anomalies, whether it was the searing droughts that basically cooked the Russian grain basket, destroying a wheat crop there. It was the extraordinary floods down in the Queensland area of Australia, again, destroying a bunch of croplands, primarily wheat. And so we've been seeing these weather anomalies. Certainly weather has always been a complicating factor in farming, and that's always been true. But right now what we're trying to do is add about 80 million people a year to the planet through population growth. And we have farmland that's pretty much everything that can be farmed is being farmed at this point in time. We've been using fairly destructive farming practices worldwide, meaning we're strip mining the soil for nutrients. And against all of this, we now have what appear to be slightly larger than normal weather anomalies for the past few years. It creates a lot of strains on the food system. So all of these strains are here and present right now. I'm not of the view that by 2050, you know, we're going to have a food problem. I think we are literally one bad harvest away from having an extraordinarily dramatic spike in food prices beyond what we've already been experiencing. Anybody who shops knows that food inflation is running a lot higher than the government admits to. And I'm of the view that anything that individuals and communities can do to increase their food resilience right here, right now, whether it's planting a single tree in the yard that bears fruit, that these are going to be extraordinarily good investments to make from a resilience standpoint, quality of life standpoint, nutritional standpoint, whichever angle you come at it from. This is going to be a good time to sort of dust off that victory garden concept and think about that in terms of maybe our own self-interest or community interest or altruism for our neighbors, however you want to spin that. It just makes sense today, I think.
I couldn't agree more. I'm wondering, on another tack, how much pressure is the average North American feeling because of increased consumer demand in Asia? In a resource-constrained world, do we have to give up everything others gain?
Well, if you're going to adhere to this concept of free trade, meaning that, you know, grain prices are set on the world market stage and U.S. farmers are free to sell their wares anywhere they want, which is the current system, there's an extraordinary amount of strain, if you will, coming from increased demand from Asia. Soybean prices in particular, any of the base grains at this point are really experiencing extraordinary demand. China's out locking up really very long-term, very, very large contracts. Because the hidden thing in the grain story right now is that for most countries, when they import grain, what they're really doing is they're importing water. Water is the underlying difficult element in almost every single country's hopes for increased grain production. China's decimated its aquifer water tables. We're doing that here, too, but it hasn't quite pinched us yet. Of course, the Middle East is just a complete disaster because their water tables were very deep and salty and not that great to begin with because it's a desert. And so what we're really seeing is we've got a global insufficiency of water in many cases, or it's just distributed oddly compared to where the farmland is. And so China's out there importing water, as far as I'm concerned. And I do believe that we are going to be hearing more and more about rising food prices driven by this idea of both demand and possibly even scarcity.
So in response to some of these problems, I've seen promos for your program called Crash Course. Can you tell us about that and what is in it?
Sure. The Crash Course is my best effort. It took me years to develop, and I condensed a lot of material down. And there's three big E's that I want people to know about, and I think we have to look at all three together. We can't look at them individually anymore. The economy being one, energy being another, the environment being a third. And then under tying all three of those E's together is a fourth E, and it's called exponential growth. And it's the kind of growth that we're experiencing in population, in money supply, debt levels, number of Krispy Kreme donuts sold. I mean, we're just surrounded by these exponential functions, meaning that everything's going just a little bit faster and faster and faster. And understanding that kind of growth in the context of these three E's is essential, a central context that I think gives pretty good explanatory power for how we got here and maybe a glimpse at where we're going to end up.
Would you care to offer us a credible scenario where the current macro financial system melts down relatively quickly? What would be the warning signs, if any, and what would we as ordinary people, you know, the kind who have to go to work for our next paycheck, what would we experience?
Well, I'm holding my fingers really close together. We came this close in 2008. And I had warned, you know, people at my site and some of my subscribers, I'd warned that we were very close to a banking system meltdown. I was looking at things in the financial world. I spent a lot of time looking in the financial world because one of the things it is, it's a great communication device. There are millions of self-interested eyeballs out there looking at stuff. And so in 2008, nobody came out and no government official, no banking official came out and said, wow, we're in deep crisis here. What was happening was financial shares, stocks were getting killed. The credit spreads on their underlying debt were blowing out, meaning that, you know, investors in their debt were dumping them like crazy. And just a couple of warning signs like that told me that we were in really deep problems. And, of course, nobody admitted to that. 2 years later, 2010, Mervyn King, Bank of England governor, comes out and says, hey, you know, we just want you to know, we were about 4 hours away from a complete systemic banking crisis back in 2008. And what that would have meant to the average person is a banking crisis works like this. A big bank, maybe it was Lehman Brothers in 2008, but it could be somebody new today, a Spanish bank, a French bank, a U.S. bank, doesn't matter. But one really big giant, one of the top 20 banks, gets into trouble, and none of the other banks will deal with it because they don't know if this institution is good for it. So they won't honor letters of credit, credit swaps, any sort of bank transfers, nothing. This bank sort of becomes a pariah. And all of a sudden, because that one bank is a pariah, they can't honor their agreements, and then another bank becomes a pariah, and the whole thing happens in a domino effect, and next thing you know, nobody will do business with anybody at the banking level. Well, as soon as that happens, everything changes very, very rapidly. That would result in what we would call a bank holiday. Officials would come out and say, well, there's a little bit of, there's some situations we have to clear up. Banks aren't going to open globally for, you know, or at least in the Western nations this week. We're hoping we'll have them open again next week. And they'll be quickly trying to figure out what goes on behind the scenes. But what does that mean? Well, for gasoline to go from the distributor out to the retail levels, for the trucks to roll across the highways, for ships to go in the ocean, requires a functioning credit system. And that requires a functioning banking system. So if our banking system shuts down, I would imagine that there will be some fairly dramatic cascading effects into our just-in-time global delivery system for everything from food to fuel to medical supplies and prescriptions, you name it. Everything sort of moves by this very large, as I mentioned, it's a very cost-effective system. If the trucks roll into your community every night, you will have food the next day. But if that system, for whatever reason, slows down, we will suddenly see very, very large, dramatic impacts, which we saw sort of a microcosm of that with the tsunami in Japan. It shut down a couple of key factories because of the damage that happened. And one example, there was this lithium polymer ion company. This is what they do. And they make this funny substance that's used in batteries that are shaped in certain devices. But this was the only plant that made it. And because of that, they didn't have enough of this polymer, which, you know, allows them to make these batteries. And the next thing you knew, all kinds, it was a huge hiccup in the worldwide delivery of electronic devices. So that is an example of a cascading effect. But what I'm talking about, if the banking holiday happens, it's not a single factory that shuts down. It's potentially an entire region. It's potentially whole industries. It could be very, very serious. This is why I'm convinced the authorities, will do everything possible to prevent that. But if they can't, I think people should be prepared. And a few of the simple things that I recommend people do is have some actual physical cash out of the bank, just in case, like we saw with Katrina in 2005, when the ATMs didn't work down there anymore. Cash really helped. This would be a similar example. And to whatever extent possible, if you have goods, be it food or clothing or whatever, that you can reasonably buy and in advance, meaning you will be using these things up anyway in the normal course of things, this is the deep pantry concept, but I might extend that to sort of a deep closet, a deep basement. Just sort of think about what happens if you can't every day jump in your car and get exactly what you need in that minute. What would you do? You know, what sorts of things are relevant in your life? It's not a huge extensive list, but just building a little buffer, a little inventory in our own lives, I think just makes sense today.
Listeners, you just got some good advice from Chris Martinson, the investment expert who's not afraid to look a bear in the face. And you can find out a lot more on his website, chrismartinson.com. Chris, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight.
Alex, it's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We have a fascination for disaster, don't we? It sells in the movies and the news. Fearing the future may be part of our evolutionary brain that got us this far. Matthew Stein doesn't just think about it. He plans, writes, and advises how to survive emergencies and crises of all kinds. With his MIT training in engineering, Matt's built off-grid homes that would probably survive hurricanes. His books include When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide for Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival, and his giant reference work, When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. First, we're going to talk about a possible quick planet-wrecking event, and then get to a few tips for surviving a longer period of troubled times. Matt Stein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure being on your show today.
I've enjoyed several of your interviews, and listeners have written in asking to hear you, so I'm glad we finally get a chance to talk. Matt, I've been surfing Google News just a week ago. I saw a brilliant NASA image of a giant solar flare, and it was very beautiful. But in the Huffington Post a while ago, you warned there could be a problem if one of those big solar storms hits the Earth. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's actually a huge problem, and it's guaranteed to happen. And what it is, the sun sort of belches every, fairly often actually. It's like a big bubble of hot, supercharged plasma from the sun goes blasting off into space about 1,000 times faster than our rockets can fly. And most of the time it just flies out harmlessly into space far away from planet Earth. But every now and then we get either a glancing or a direct blow. So we've had about 100 significant solar storms in the last 150 years. And we had one about a month ago, and it lit up the sky pretty brilliant. You might have seen some where you live in British Columbia. It lit it up phosphorescent green on Lake Michigan. So it got somewhat south, but it was kind of like a nice light show, but no really big deal. And there was a few flights changed, a minor disruption in communications, and that's it. But every now and then, the Earth gets socked by a really huge solar storm called an extreme geomagnetic event. And if that was to happen today, then life as we know it would cease to exist for many people on the planet. And let me explain that. See, the last time a really huge geomagnetic storm struck our planet was in 1921. And it was a two-day-long event, and it lit up the skies, brilliant colors, from the North Pole all the way south to Haiti and Hawaii, and from the South Pole all the way as far north as Samoa. So the entire planet, except for a narrow sliver in the deep tropical zones, was lit up at nighttime for two nights. Now, when the last geomagnetic extreme event hit, it was not a big deal for the planet. I mean, there was no big electric grid. There were no nuclear power plants. There was no internet in those days. And so when it struck, it caused some electrical havoc in some cities. It burned down Penn Central Station from induced currents. And the time before that one struck was 1859, an even bigger storm hit. It was a week-long global light show event. And in 1859, when it hit, it actually burned down a few telegraph stations. It set some telegraph lines and poles on fire. And again, the world kind of went around like normal. Well, fast forward to today. Today we have, in the United States alone, we have 100,000 miles of extra high voltage power lines that interconnect our grid. Those things didn't exist in 1921. There was just individual electrified cities, and most of the countryside was totally unelectrified, and there was no interconnecting grid. So today, if that storm from 1921 hit, you'd have 100,000 miles of power lines acting like a giant antenna. And when that geomagnetic storm hits, they would be sucking up an incredible pulse of energy that had been started from that mass ejection coming out of the sun. Now, what does that do? Well, it runs down those power lines, and at the ends of each of these power lines is something called an extra high voltage transformer. These are like 350,000 volts up to 1,000,000 volt transformers. And when it hits those, they burn up. And when they burn up, then our grid stops working. Now, people say, well, okay, big deal. So you burn a few transformers, you can go down to the hardware supply, buy another transformer, right? It's like, no, these are custom-made transformers. They're like 25 feet tall. They're 300 tons each. They're tens of millions of dollars each. They have to shut down a freeway when they deliver one of these giant transformers. And I mean, this is a huge deal. What you're talking about is in a two-day storm like 1921, you're talking about burning a third of these transformers in North America. That's 350 of them. Now, we built this transformer system, and we put these big transformers in over three decades, from 1970s, 80s, and 90s, to pretty much replace and revamp the American power grid. And you're talking in 2 hours cooking most of those. Now, how long are we down for? Well, if we blow 350 in North America, 2,000 worldwide, that's about 10 to 20 years worth of production at maximum capacity when the world's still working well. So we're looking at a situation where the power's down over not all of North America, but most of the populated and densely populated areas for months to years. Now, what does that mean? Well, 3 days of food supply in our major cities. Used to be 3 decades ago, they had a month's worth of food in warehouses at every major city. But now everything's coordinated by the Internet. It's all just-in-time deliveries. So the food you're going to eat on Monday is still on a truck on Thursday, getting ready to be delivered somewhere in the city. So when the grid goes down, then all of a sudden, there's no oil being refined. There's no water being pumped. There's no water being purified. There's no sewage being pumped. There's no elevators running. There's no air conditioners running. There's no television, TV, no Internet. Washington, D.C. is shut down. The stock market collapses. The military can't function without the grid. See, we have a world that's totally dependent on the grid. But now, there's an even bigger problem. And that's why my article is titled 400 Chernobyls, and I'll explain that. See, every nuclear power plant in the world right now as it's configured today, they're designed so that when the grid goes down or has a severe anomaly, they automatically go into emergency shutdown mode. See, they can't operate without being hooked into the grid. So when the grid goes down, they start shutting themselves down. And it's not like flipping a switch on your light, and all of a sudden you flip the switch and all the lights go out in your house. This is a different situation. When a nuclear power plant shuts down, it starts slowing the reaction down. It doesn't stop it like a flip of a switch. So you have a huge amount of heat that's normally boiling millions of gallons of water to create steam to run giant turbines that can power an entire city off a single nuclear power plant. Now, all of a sudden, all that heat has to go somewhere. So what they do is they have cooling system pumps that keep cooling and running the water through the cores and run them up to towers to cool them. Well, when Fukushima failed, according to the Japanese authorities, it wasn't the earthquake directly that caused those power plants, those nuclear reactors, to melt down. What happened is the earthquake took down the grid. So what do the power plants do? Well, they automatically go into emergency shutdown mode. So immediately, backup generators and battery packs kick in, start driving the pumps to keep those reactors cooling so that they don't burn themselves up. Well, 20 minutes later, the tsunami comes along, wipes out the backup batteries and the backup generators, and the pumps stop working, and the cores on those reactors start overheating. And in between 15 minutes and a few hours later, they've critically overheated and failed. And then what happened is you got super hot nuclear reactor cores, and they're in contact with water, and they start dissociating the water into hydrogen and oxygen. Well, these reactors are designed supposedly to have really thick containment vessels, like 6-foot-thick walls of concrete and steel, to try and keep all that stuff inside in case there's a problem with the reactor. Well, when the water hit those super hot cores and made hydrogen and oxygen gas, the gases floated up to the top of the reactor containment vessel, and they recombined and exploded and blew the vessel. So not only did you have reactor cores that had melted down critically and permanently destroyed the reactor, you've now blown the containment vessel and they're leaking.
You could see this happening right around the world if we had one of these solar storm events. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So what happens in the world now? You've got a weak supply of fuel mandated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at each and every one of these reactors. You've got 104 of them in America. 37% of all Americans live within 50 miles of a nuclear reactor because they build these things not right in the city but close to the cities because they don't want to, you know, they want to generate the power near where they're going to use it so they don't lose a lot of power and transmission losses. So a week later, after one of these giant solar storms has knocked the grid out in most of the densely populated parts of the country, and in fact parts of the industrial world, these power plants are going to start running out of fuel. Now, some people called me up and said, Mr. Stein, you know, I work in a nuclear power plant, and we've got a month's worth of food. Okay, so you got a month's worth of food. Well, the Congressional Bipartisan Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, EMP Commission, determined that it was probably going to be 4 to 10 years before we really get the grid rolling well again after an event like this. And that was verified in an independent study by the National Academy of Sciences. So we're looking at not days, not weeks, but in the best case, we're looking at months, and in the worst case, many years before things get up to speed again. So I just can't imagine if you had a situation where it's equal to like 100 Hurricane Katrinas going off in America all at once, and there's riots in the street, and people aren't, there's no food, and there's no communication, there's no power, there's no heat. I just can't imagine that diesel fuel trucks are going to show up like clockwork, like the government officials have promised, at each and every one of our 104 nuclear power plants in this country to make sure that when they run out of backup fuel, that they've got a fresh supply of fuel on hand to keep them running. So we're looking at a situation that's horrible without the nuclear part. And when you add in the nuclear part to the equation, you're looking at an end of the world as we know it and possibly the extinction of human beings and mammalian life. Now, there's a good news, bad news side to the story. The good news is, for $1 billion, half the price of a B-2 stealth bomber, half the price of one of those single bombers, we could implement new technology that's just been developed and it's been proven in EMP simulation chambers to work. It's new vacuum tube-based technology. You think, well, vacuum tubes, that's old technology. Well, no, these are like giant special vacuum tubes. They found solid-state devices just weren't fast enough and robust enough to do the job. So they've developed technology that can protect each of these giant transformers from the massive surge coming down the line from either an electromagnetic pulse from a nuclear detonation from some rogue state or terrorist group or from a super solar storm. So for only $1 billion, which is pretty small change in the scope of things when you compare the bank bailout, we could prevent the end of the world as we know it. And for another $1 billion or so, we could mandate that there's a year's worth of fuel on hand at each and every nuclear installation, that there's backup generators and backup critical components for the control systems that are stored in EMP-hardened containers at each and every one of these nuclear power plants. So for $2 billion, the price of a stealth bomber, and a tiny fraction of the price of the TARP bank bailout, we could prevent the end of the world as we know it. Now, we can't prevent every bad thing from happening, from an electromagnetic pulse attack from a terrorist, or from a solar storm from the sun, an extreme solar storm, but we can prevent the end of the world as we know it. We can prevent the collapse of society, the collapse of the stock market, the collapse of the government, the collapse of everything that keeps our world of 7 billion people running and fed and, you know, reasonably working reasonably well. We can prevent that from going away in a poof.
Well, you know, Matt, it's just sort of a sign of our almost suicidal mentality that we just haven't gone ahead and spent that money right away. And I have to say, too, that, you know, we've got to do it around the world. What we found with Fukushima is a reactor can blow on the other side of the world and the whole northern hemisphere gets irradiated. So it has to go in wherever there are nuclear plants. And frankly, I think we should shut down the nuclear plants because we're not on top of this technology. But we do need to move on. So this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with disaster expert Matthew Stein about events that happened in the past and will happen again. We just can't say when. We started with a low probability, super high risk event we call a solar storm, which could cause nuclear reactors around the world to melt down. Find a link to Matt's article, 400 Chernobyls, Solar Flares, EMP, and Nuclear Armageddon, in my blog at ecoshock.info or at Matt's blog at whentechfails.com. Now, Matt, I'd like to move on to another projected event with no fixed date. We've spoken to several guests who expect just-in-time shipping methods will feed us all, but they could stop on short notice for a number of reasons. As you pointed out, it could be a war, could be a new virus, or a sudden economic breakdown like the one that almost happened in 2008. So let's assume we don't fall into violent anarchy if the industrial system hiccups and our better intentions come out and we want to survive as communities. Before we get to some solutions, which you do offer, Matt, what are the early challenges we face when technology fails like that?
Well, you know, everybody, I believe, should have what's called a 72-hour grab-and-run kit. And if you go to whentechfails.com and click on articles, you'll see a lot of great, totally free information, including a bunch of recommended items, about 25 or 30 items in that. And what the grab and run kit, or some people call it bug out bags, survival kits, it basically provides for you and your family the critical things you need in the first few days of a crisis. So it provides for fresh drinking water, the ability to purify water, provides food, shelter, clothing, first aid, basic medicines, whatever you might need to get by for a few days. I mean, we've seen in all kinds of crises that, you know, if it's a big crisis like the Kobe, Japan quake or Hurricane Katrina, that the authorities are just totally overloaded, and to count on somebody coming in to do it for you is just plain wishful thinking. So that's kind of like the first thing. Then the next step is to look at local self-resilience. You know, what is it that we can do so that if the global economy is not working, if the world shipping is shut down, if the Pakistan and India threw nukes at each other, or, you know, the spent fuel ponds go up in Japan and it's thrown a wrench into the entire world's machine that makes the world go round, how can you deal with things in a longer term? And in that, you're starting to look at things like trade and barter. You're looking at things like, can you grow food? Can you forage for food? For instance, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there's sort of two countries that are often talked about as an example of, you know, how can we deal with the peak in world oil production, and what would happen if the global machine stopped? And those two countries are Cuba and North Korea. See, both of those countries depended on the Soviet Union for their supply line, for spare parts, for automobiles, for, you know, air conditioners, for oil, for coal, you know, the kinds of things that support a technological society. It's like, you know, they weren't tied into America in any way, shape, or form, so they looked to the Soviets for that. So when the Soviet Union collapsed in the mid-1990s, then all of a sudden their pipeline got shut off. Well, the two countries are the two examples of one doing it right, meaning Cuba, and two doing it wrong, meaning North Korea. So if you lived in North Korea and you weren't part of the government, then you were totally on your own. You had no electricity. You had no access to food. You probably didn't have potable water. You know, you're kind of scrapping along for yourself. So the people who made it through that were good at foraging, were good at black market and trade and barter. All of the rats and mice got eaten quite quickly, cockroaches, grasshoppers, all of that stuff. If you weren't good at combing the mountainside for edible plants and foods and roots, then you probably starved, unless you had a pipeline into the government for supplies. Now, in Cuba, it was a sort of an opposite story. In Cuba, it was like, okay, how can we work together to solve this problem? What's the power of community in Cuba? Now, granted, they had a more benign climate, so that was in their favor. But essentially, they switched over to draft animals and old-fashioned organic farming methods and old-fashioned tools. And they went, you know, meat consumption went way down. The average Cuban lost about 25 or 30 pounds of weight, but they were actually probably healthier. They switched over from pharmaceutical medicines to homeopathy and herbal-based medicines. And, you know, the country did really quite well. I mean, nobody died of starvation, or very few, and life went on, and, you know, there was disruptions, but they worked together and made it all work out.
Huh. Well, you know, Matt, in an emergency, some people go into non-responsive shock. We saw it in New Orleans after Katrina, and Asia after the tsunamis, in towns that are blown away by hurricanes or storms. But other folks come alive in an emergency. They go into some kind of overdrive to organize for survival. And I'm wondering, does that come from thinking about these things in advance, or do you think it's social or genetic differences that freeze some folks while empowering others? What are your thoughts?
Yes. All of the above. Certainly, being prepared ahead of time, and my big book, When Technology Fails, goes into the whole thing of self-reliance and sustainability. So about half of the book is about emergency preparedness, food storage, survival, alternative healing, first aid. Those kinds of skills are quite helpful in a situation. And the other half of the book, well, it's kind of a third in the survival preparedness, about a third on sustainability and self-reliance, and then about a third is sort of old-fashioned technologies, because in the days of our grandparents or in some people's great-great-grandparents, someone in every small town in America knew how to grow, fabricate, or make whatever was needed for a reasonable standard of living and survival. And so in the, there's power in community because nobody can, no one person can know and do it all. And in a community like that, you know, someone could blow glass, someone could do pottery, someone could weave cloth, someone could tan leather, someone could make that leather into leather goods and saddles, things like that. But those skills have been, for the most part, lost in our modern day where everything's built in factories, mostly in foreign countries thousands of miles away from here. So the last third of when technology fails is kind of like teaching the rudiments of all of those skills that people knew a couple hundred years ago. Someone in the town knew, not everybody, but somebody knew them. And those things could be very valuable again. Now, in a crisis, it usually brings out the best in people. The media tends to focus on the worst and the thug action and, you know, the raping and pillaging part. And that does happen, but usually it brings out the best in people and they pool together. And certainly, having thought about it, having prepared yourself mentally and physically, and having learned some skills, those are all wonderful things to do, and they'll only help you in a situation like that. But there are some people who, in spite of their preparations, just fall to pieces, and there are other people who aren't prepared, but something inside of them kicks in, and they step up to the plate, and they, you know, it brings out strengths that they perhaps before hadn't known they had. So there are no general rules. They're just guidelines.
You know, I think that's a good reason why people should go to an Occupy meeting, because there you're looking at a situation where there is no authority, and that's exactly what could happen. And you're looking at how groups of people who don't know each other too well, maybe at the start, learn to communicate with one another and get some action going and get the basic things. Some of those Occupy camps, you know, they worked out the water, the food, the sewage, the communications, the entertainment, self-education, all of that happened pretty quickly, and I think that's a good example. So I'm encouraging listeners, if you have some more Occupy things happening, get out there and have a look. I wanted to move on to James Howard Kunstler. He's written about when oil supplies run out, a couple of novels, and he calls it the long emergency, which you've adopted in your book as well. How do your ideas work into that scenario of a long, slow descent?
Well, I don't see any way out of that at this point in time without some kind of magical new technology sort of to bail us out. Now, we've reached, I've written an article called The Perfect Storm, Six Trends Converging on Collapse. And so far, you know, we've managed to slow probably one of the six trends down somewhat, but we haven't really done anything with the other five. And the only one we've slowed down, and we certainly haven't stopped, is population growth. So I think the long emergency, it's either, we're either going to go off a cliff with some cataclysmic event or series of events, or we're going to be headed for the long emergency. And I think if you accept that that's the case, then you can see the chance for transformation in there. And I think the Occupy movement's a wonderful example in the Arab Spring of, like, inklings of this change are in the wind. Because it's quite clear to me that continuing the current trends, the way our world got where it is right now, will guarantee collapse. And I'm hoping that as proactive human beings with brains in our heads, that we can actually wake up and change the course of where we're headed. Now, unfortunately, the people who are at the top and the corporations at the top got there through the old model, and so they have a huge stake in keeping the old model going. So it's kind of one of these things of, do we get shaken up badly enough to make major changes, or do we just allow momentum and business as usual to take us over the cliff? So the sort of better scenario is it's a long, slow emergency where it gives us time to adapt and time to sort of get ready and prepare and shift the way we do things and what we accept in our life as that this is the general trend we're headed in. Unfortunately, the way exponential growth tends to work is and all the models of limits to growth done at MIT in the 1970s indicate that without proactive intervention, it's probably going to be more like a fairly rapid fall off of a cliff or a very steep downslope rather than a long, slow emergency.
So, Matt, I've got to ask you on a personal level, why do you focus on such negative futures?
Well, I also focus, I call myself the optimistic doomer. So the last chapter in When Technology Fails is called Making the Shift to Sustainability. And I have a new book I'd like to get out called Making Shift Happen, Changing Course from Collapse to Renaissance. So I believe that if we're going to have a positive future, then we have to first acknowledge rather than deny the truth of where our trends are going and look at them quite realistically, because so long as we kind of deny that they're headed for that cliff or that train wreck, then we're really not going to do the significant changes we need to make in order to avoid the train wreck or avoid the going off the cliff.
Our guest, Matthew Stein, has worked for renewable energy, sustainable growth, and alternative healing techniques. You can find his websites at mattstein.com, stein-design.com, and www.whentechfails.com. If you really want to know what to do if the lights go out, make sure you have a copy of Matt's latest encyclopedic work called When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. And I recommend the paper version of that in case the internet isn't working. We may not be able to Google the next solution. Matt, we've got to have you back to get more tips out of you. I'm sorry we're out of time now. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Alex, and have a great day. I like to leave people with my motto, and I ask people to do their best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. Thank you so much for having me on today.
We'll do that. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with a couple of important messages. We need to have a little talk. Pull up a chair. You may want to be sitting down for this. Despite what you may have heard, the end is not coming in 2012. Yes, a big solar storm is possible. As Matt Stein said, that could end civilization as we know it, but that's a high-risk, low-probability event. Don't quit your day job waiting for it, unless you want to quit your day job anyway and have another plan to make a living. An economic crash is possible, but far from guaranteed. I expect the banks to open next week, next month, and probably next year. The civilization has a lot of momentum. We humans have the flexibility to keep going. Even when three reactors melted down on a small island, millions of people went back to their regular jobs and lives. That is the real problem. A growing number of scientists say without an economic crash, we will continue to wreck the world in some ways that cannot be repaired and may not be survivable for mammals in the future. Our biggest problem may not be that the world will end this year, but that it won't. Millions of humans are responding to this existential threat with a strange desire to see the collapse of absolutely everything. Money will be worthless, they say. Anarchy will be the norm. There are really odd ideas popping up all over the internet. Our new means of mass communication by and for the masses has also exposed an echo chamber for all the weirdest fringes. Look, I could build up a really solid following by telling you this is the last week of Radio EcoShock. The collapse is coming next week, so stock up on food and water because the whole system is going down. I could probably do that every week for a few years and still have a loyal following. It's like the bands where the lead singer collapses, the audience is worried, but somehow the star revives and struggles back by sheer willpower to play three more songs. Stage magic. Even worse, the magic of the internet is connecting up a style of medieval thinking and emotion I hoped we'd left behind us. No, a strange dark planet is not about to appear and envelop us in evil. The distant Pleiades stars are not driving human affairs. David Icke can pack theaters with his stories of evil reptiles in human form. David Wilcox claims he's channeled alien voices, which will be revealed in a television special with President Obama, a two-hour special no less, this year. We don't know why the Mayans ended their calendar in 2012. They didn't say. We do know Sony Motion Pictures is milking popular superstition to sell lots of box office tickets on that fear. Sony has a long-running net and YouTube campaign to make you afraid this year. Fear sells. While millions are packing into the 2012 fantasy, the multi-billionaires continue to rake in more of the world's wealth, more or less unseen. As always, plenty of Christians also believe they will be physically lifted off the earth as the Antichrist goes into a last battle right now, this year. They've believed that for 2,000 years. I'm calling BS on all that. The truth is horrifying enough. We have serious changes to make, and these 2012 rumors are just distractions. It is true our industrial system has taken fragility to the max to wring out billions more profits for the few. You should have some fallback food and water around the house, or at least deep pantries, as Matt Stein suggested. I also recommend having a little money at home in case the ATMs stop working for a while, as Chris Martinson said. But neither of these guests promised that this is the year of collapse. The end may not be nigh. Sorry, but 2012 is just another year. I expect to be making useful radio programs in 2013.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find.
Let's list out a few real problems. One, we continue to grow the human population even though we can't feed those already here. Two, we are wasting the limited resource of fossil fuels, leaving little for coming generations. Three, we can't burn what we have because we are wrecking the atmosphere with pollution that threatens all life on Earth. That sounds like a big one to me. Four, even if we could burn them all, we are hacking down and poisoning the natural life support system in other ways, from pesticides to plastics filling the oceans. The richness of life on Earth is going extinct. Five, our economic system is unfair to the majority of people on the planet right now and to the next generations. When we create trillions or quadrillions in debt, we are lying to ourselves and borrowing from the future. That is unsustainable and will collapse, whether suddenly or slowly. Nobody knows when. Six, we continue to use nuclear technology for power and weapons even after their irreparable danger and terrible consequences are fully known. Seven, although we have limited our past history of all-out war, militarism continues and it soaks up the budgets and all the money that we need for other things, and social and family violence continues as well. And that leads us to our central problem. In all of the above, we are showing an inability to respond to reality, to do something about these situations, even when solutions exist. Instead, we continue to adopt and spread fantasies which do not address reality. These delusions make it less likely we will survive our self-made challenges, and more likely our children and grandchildren will suffer. The TV weathermen just call it strange or weird weather. They seldom call it global warming. Even scientists have said over and over for years now, you can't call any one season climate change. Now the leading American climate scientist, the man who warned Congress of this coming change in 1988, says the heat events in recent years are due to human activity. NASA's Dr. James Hansen, along with Mikiko Sato and Ruto Reedy, have published a new paper called Public Perception of Climate Change and the New Climate Dice. It's a game changer. Without going into detail, this paper explains how we can know, scientifically, these extreme weather events would not have happened without human modification of the climate by burning fossil fuels. The dice are loaded, and they will continue to come up hot many more times than cold. That means our climate and life for all things, time to the seasons, will get stranger and stranger. We are committed to at least a century of climate disruption and warming for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. In future Radio EcoShock shows, I'll be looking at ways we can adapt while still fighting to contain the damage. I should have given up hope, but that is not an option for me as long as I love my children and hold my grandchild. You shouldn't give up hope either. We can make a significant difference. We can make a better society. We can live better with nature. But we can't do it by indulging in a mass psychosis where aliens are causing all our problems, or by hoping to see the end times. Please, let's keep our minds clear, even as others fall into delusion or despair. The sun will rise tomorrow, in 2013 and in 2100. Despite difficult times, many, many people will experience love, happiness, and fulfillment, even as they struggle to make a better world. Join that party. Join them. Join us. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org.